Welcome, Curious Minds, to another deep dive. Today, we're plunging into, well, one of the most profound and maybe unsettling analyses of human behavior ever written, Elias Canetti's Crowds and Power. It's a book that really peels back the layers of why we act the way we do in groups, you know, revealing these raw, primal forces underneath.
Yeah, it was pretty intense stuff.
So our mission today really is to try and unearth the psychological dynamics behind why we gather, how groups act, and crucially, what drives people to seek power and wield it. We're drawing on Canetti's own work, obviously. He spent, what, 30 years writing this?
Yeah, over 30 years. It was his magnum opus, for sure. And it's not just some dusty old theory. This deep dive gives us this unique lens, incredibly relevant, I think, for looking at everything from, say, a concert crowd to a political rally, even, you know, online communities, which can get pretty wild.
Oh, definitely.
Canetti wrote this decades ago, but honestly, his insights feel so vital for understanding today. Populism, social media, that whole tension between wanting to be an individual but also craving belonging.
Mm-hmm. That push and pull.
Exactly. It's all in there.
So what's the takeaway for you listening right now?
Well, by the end of this, you won't just sort of know what happens in crowds. Hopefully you'll have a new vocabulary, a new framework, really, for interpreting the collective stuff you see every single day.
Yeah, decoding those hidden currents.
Whether you're just scrolling your feed, watching the news, or even just people watching. Okay, so let's unpack this a bit. Who was Elias Canetti? His life story is so tied up in this book.
It really is.
Born in Bulgaria, 1905. German language writer, won the Nobel Prize for Literature later on in 81. And he wasn't just a nonfiction guy. He was a polymath, plays, a novel, memoirs.
A real intellectual powerhouse.
But Crowds and Power, that was the big one. 30 years, like we said. And he wasn't just some academic observing from afar. He lived through some heavy history.
Oh, absolutely. Growing up multicultural in the Balkans, then witnessing the rise of Nazism firsthand in Vienna.
Terrifying.
And then living in exile. He wasn't just reading about it. He was in it. And that experience must have shaped his perspective, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned he wasn't a typical academic.
Not at all. That's what's so distinctive. He wasn't like a sociologist crunching numbers or a historian just listing dates. He was this deeply perceptive observer, almost like a poet meets a forensic psychologist, if that makes sense.
I get that.
His authority comes from pulling together this huge range of knowledge, mythology, religion, history, even zoology, not just data.
Wow.
And his personal trauma, witnessing mass movements, seeing leaders like Hitler up close, that absolutely fueled this lifelong obsession he had with understanding what he called collective madness.
Collective madness.
It was like he needed to figure out what he'd lived through. It wasn't just intellectual curiosity. It felt deeper.
And that leads us right to the book's big question, doesn't it?
Mm.
What are these primitive, maybe irrational forces that make us form crowds? And then how do powerful figures manipulate those crowds?
Exactly.
He called it trying to create a pathology of the masses. What did he mean by pathology there? Like diagnosing a disease.
Precisely. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. He saw these group behaviors not just as social things, but almost like a psychological illness or an aberration, a deviation from rational individual thought that needed to be diagnosed.
Understood at its root.
Right. Why do seemingly normal, rational people do things in a crowd they'd never do alone? That was the puzzle he wanted to solve.
Okay. So let's dive into some of his core ideas.
Mm-hmm.
He starts with this concept, the primal fear of being touched.
Fundamental.
Our default state as individuals. He argues we all have this deep primal fear of being touched by the unknown. It's instinct, right?
Mm-hmm.
Defining our personal space, our identity.
Yeah, that bubble.
He wrote, all the distances that men create around themselves are dictated by this fear. It's about safety, maintaining boundaries.
But then, and this is where it gets really fascinating.
Yeah.
He talks about the reversal of that fear inside the crowd.
The flip.
Exactly. In that dense, pulsating mass, suddenly all those distinctions, status, individuality, they just dissolve.
Yeah.
And that fear of touch, it morphs into a desire for contact, for unity, this feeling of being invincible together.
Ah, okay.
That's what he calls the discharge. It's this incredibly powerful moment of liberation, equality. You feel yourself just melt away.
Wow. Discharge. That's a strong word.
It is. Imagine shedding all your burdens, your name, job, worries, and just merging into this bigger thing. It's intoxicating. A total escape from being just you alone.
I can almost feel that. You know, you think about being packed shoulder to shoulder at a huge concert or maybe a sports final when everyone erupts.
Exactly that feeling.
Or a festival, everyone moving together, that intense connection with strangers where boundaries just blur.
Mm-hmm.
That's the discharge.
That's it. It's incredibly powerful, almost addictive, like you said.
Okay, if you lose yourself that completely, what are the risks? Beyond just, you know, getting caught up in the moment.
Well, that's the crucial downside, isn't it? The discharge frees you, yes, but it also strips away your critical thinking, your individual responsibility. When you're part of that unified whole, you become incredibly susceptible to suggestion, ready to follow the collective impulse.
Easily steered.
Very easily steered by a leader or just by the mood of the crowd itself. The very thing that liberates you makes you vulnerable to manipulation. Your independent judgment is just suspended. Temporarily, maybe, but suspended.
Okay, so that vulnerability leads us to Kennedy's analysis of power. It's not just politics or economics for him, is it?
No, it's deeply psychological. He boils power down to its fundamental unit, the command.
The command.
And he talks about the sting of command, that feeling of humiliation, powerlessness that's left in you when you're forced to obey someone.
Oof. Yeah, I think we can all relate to that sting at some point.
Right. And these stings, they don't just disappear. They accumulate. They build up this resentment, this pent-up tension inside individuals and collectively inside groups.
So where does all that tension go?
Well, this is where it gets really dark, actually.
Okay.
Kennedy introduces this chilling archetype, the survivor.
The survivor.
He argues that a ruler's ultimate power isn't just measured by commands, but by the number of people they have outlived, especially those they condemn to death themselves.
Whoa.
The absolute peak moment of power for Kennedy's survivor is standing alive amidst the dead.
That's bleak.
It is. But he argues this deep-seated, maybe subconscious desire to be the last one standing explains the paranoia, the cruelty of so many tyrants throughout history.
Where you see it. Sultans killing their brothers, dictators purging rivals.
Exactly. They're seeking that ecstatic moment of survival, as Kennedy called it, eliminating threats, potential rivals, even family, to cement their position as the sole survivor. It's a terrifying drive.
And how does this survivor figure connect back to the crowd and its discharge?
Well, the paranoid, survival-obsessed ruler is masterful at manipulating the crowd's desire for that discharge, that unity.
Ah, using their need.
Using their need for belonging and release to achieve the ruler's own ends, often, you know, with devastating consequences. The ruler channels the crowd's energy, directs its potential fury, all while positioning themselves as the indispensable one, the survivor who guarantees the group's existence, even as they eliminate threats within or outside it.
It's a chilling feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
The crowd wants discharge. The survivor provides a target or a direction, feeding their own need to outlive others.
Precisely. The Roman triumph, Kennedy mentions the general parading captives. That's a public display of survival, reinforcing power through the visual of the vanquished.
Okay, so we've got the individual fear, the crowd's release, the sting of command, the survivor. But what is the crowd itself? Kennedy actually breaks it down, right? Gives it attributes.
He does. He anatomizes it, like you said earlier. He identifies four essential attributes.
Okay, what are they?
First, density. Crowds need to be compact, physically close. Second, equality. Inside the crowd, everyone feels fundamentally equal. Status disappears.
Right, that melting away.
Third, direction. Crowds are always moving towards something, a shared goal, whether it's physical or symbolic. And fourth, growth. The open crowd, he calls it, has this insatiable desire to grow, to pull everyone in.
Like a living thing, almost. Density, equality, direction, growth.
Yeah, and what's insightful is how these attributes create this psychological vortex. They draw people in and weaken individual autonomy even before a leader steps up. They create the conditions for that discharge.
It's not just descriptive, it's functional.
Exactly. And he goes further, categorizing them. Open versus closed crowds, like a spontaneous mob versus a contained church service. Rhythmic versus stagnating marching soldiers versus people stuck waiting.
Quick versus slow crowds too, right? Like panic versus a pilgrimage.
Yes. And he even talks about crowd symbols, fire, a river, a forest, things in nature that embody the crowd's overwhelming qualities.
Fascinating. And he connects this back to something even more ancient. The pack.
Right. The pack is the precursor, the evolutionary building block of the crowd. Smaller, older, more goal-oriented.
What kinds of packs?
He describes a few key ones. The hunting pack, the oldest, focused on a common prey. The war pack, disciplined for fighting. The lamenting pack, gathered in grief, which he saw as the origin of religious feeling.
Interesting connection.
And the increase pack, focused on fertility, growth, communal prosperity. For Kennedy, These ancient pack structures are the deep foundations of basically all our complex social institutions today.
So even in a modern office or political party, we're seeing echoes of the hunting pack or the war pack.
That's his argument. Understanding these ancient dynamics helps us see the fundamental drives operating beneath the surface of modern life. It suggests these patterns are incredibly deep-rooted.
Okay, so this isn't just theory about the past.
Yeah.
How does this framework help us understand things now?
Oh, immensely. That's the real power of Canetti, I think. These archaic patterns are absolutely alive and kicking in contemporary society. They're just maybe repackaged or happening online.
Okay, give us some examples. Where do you see this playing out?
Well, think about political populism and nationalism. It's almost textbook Canetti.
So?
Leaders are often experts at cultivating crowd feeling. They foster that shared identity, create a sense of density, even if it's just ideological closeness, and then they channel the collective energy, often anger, towards common enemies.
The U.S. versus them.
Exactly. Immigrants, elites, whoever the target is, think about a rally, the charged language, simplifying everything, building that sense of shared purpose. It's designed to create that discharge moment, that feeling of unity against a threat.
And the leader often embodies that survivor archetype, right?
Right.
The one who will protect us.
Precisely. You can definitely spot those techniques if you look closely at political rhetoric today.
What about online? You mentioned that earlier.
Social media mobs. It's a perfect example of the quick crowd.
Oh.
Think about viral movements or, you know, cancel culture. They form incredibly rapidly. There's usually a very clear target. There's a strong sense of equality and moral certainty among the participants.
Right. Everyone piling on feels justified.
And there's that digital discharge. The satisfaction, the release that comes from collective condemnation, it's a virtual crowd, but the psychological mechanics.
Yeah.
Eerily similar to what Canetti described.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? Are we all just one click away from joining a digital pack, losing ourselves in that online outrage?
It's a sobering thought, and it's not just politics or online, even in the workplace.
How does it apply there?
That sting of command we talked about, it's incredibly real in corporate culture. It affects morale, sure, but it can also subtly poison things like innovation.
Because people are afraid to speak up.
Exactly. Employees might learn it's safer to just obey, to not rock the boat, rather than offer independent thought. You can get these stagnating packs, Canetti might call them, where new ideas just wither. And sometimes you see managers who maybe unconsciously operate from that survivor mindset, seeing independent thinkers or potential rivals as threats to their position.
Creates a culture of fear, not collaboration.
Right. So understanding Canetti isn't just about watching the news. It's about understanding the dynamics in your own office, potentially.
So beyond analyzing society, what's the personal takeaway?
I think it's about personal psychological awareness. The book is a huge cautionary tale, really, about how tempting it is to just lose yourself in a group, to surrender your own thinking.
It makes you wary.
Deeply skeptical, yeah. Towards any ideology, any movement that demands you completely give up your critical thought. Understanding that pull, that seductive feeling of the crowd's discharge, helps you stay aware of your own vulnerability.
To groupthink, to manipulation.
Whether it's political, religious, social, online or offline, it helps you hopefully maintain your autonomy, your ability to think for yourself, even when collective pressures are strong.
So wrapping this up, maybe the biggest lesson from digging into crowds and power is just realizing that beneath our modern rational surface, these ancient, powerful, sometimes frankly terrifying instincts are still running the show.
Mm-hmm. They haven't gone away.
And we've got this new vocabulary now, right? Fear of the touch, the discharge, the sting of command, the survivor pathology. These aren't just terms. They're tools. Tools for seeing what's really going on.
Potent analytical tools, absolutely. And Canetti leaves us with this kind of unsettling realization, doesn't he? That this capacity for crowd behavior, which can be amazing, transcendent, or incredibly destructive, it's just a permanent part of being human.
It's always there.
Always there, which leads to a big question for us today, I think. In this super connected world where digital crowds pop up instantly and global problems demand we act together, how do we actually harness that collective power for good?
Without falling into the traps.
Exactly. How do we build real community, take positive action, without succumbing to those primal dangers, without getting swept away by the crowd or manipulated by those who crave that survivor status? How do we keep thinking for ourselves while still acting together?
That's a lot to think about. A really powerful note to end on.
It stays with you, this book.
It really does. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by eCotra Foundation.